Our next speaker is Judith Marshall. Judith lived and worked in Mozambique for 8 years, and in that time wrote a book on literacy in Mozambique. She's a longtime committed activist around Southern African issues and a longtime member of what is, and well, one might still consider it to be around, the Toronto Committee for Links Between Southern Africa and Canada, TICLESAC. She has worked for the past 10 years with the Steelworkers Humanity Fund, which is the development and solidarity arm of the steelworkers. She is also the steelworkers rep on the Common Frontiers, one of the coalitions that was a major organizer of the People's Summit of the Americas in Quebec. So please join me in welcoming Judith Marshall.
Thanks, Marty, for that introduction. It's difficult to come third when the two speakers that have preceded you have already put out so much food for thought, and I expect that you, like me, are anxious to get into some discussion groups and take up some of those themes. But hopefully what I'll do in this third presentation is give yet more food for thought. What the organizers have asked me to do is to, in my presentation, put a little more emphasis not on the big dramatic events, the summits, the major protests throughout the globe, but more emphasis on the kind of day-to-day building of links between North and South, the kinds of links that are being forged in many, many different sectors. I suspect that all of you, if you think about your political practice today and think about what your political work looked like 10 years ago, we'll find that the work that you're doing today is very much shaped by this new terrain of North-South alliances, coalitions, networks. It may be international campaigns around water or around climate change. Certainly the environmentalists have been some of those who've been most agile in using the new information technology and finding new ways to act globally. Or it may be some of that work around death that Patrick was speaking about, where there are national and regional and north-south configurations. Or it may be work around something like the MAI, which I'm sure many in this room were involved in. I came from a meeting yesterday that was looking at the campaign now around the next WTO meetings. And again, part of the agenda of that meeting was to look at international movements and what they're doing. And many around the table brought onto the agenda what their southern counterparts were involved in and actions that they were planning together. Or it may be the World March of Women. But whatever way you look at it, I think all of us find ourselves operating in a very different context now than we have than we did some years ago. And as the other speakers have said, all of these bottom-up initiatives have a tremendous potential for change. And I think there's a real sense of hopefulness that finally the kind of unquestioned neoliberal agenda that seemed to be steamrolling over us, that finally some of these major institutions are having to account for their actions, that finally their credibility has been brought into question by the bottom-up kind of globalization pressures that have emerged so dramatically. What I'd like to do in the time that I have is to just focus on three different areas that my own organization is involved in, where this kind of gritty day-to-day work of trying to carry out a politics with southern counterparts is the order of the day. One of them is the work that we do through the Steelworkers Humanity Fund. I will focus on our own experiences, but I would like to say from the outset there are many other unions that are doing similar kinds of things, and I think the workshop this afternoon that Ken Lockhart is leading will certainly let some of the auto workers' experiences in this regard come to the fore, and those of other unions as well. So I'll focus on those, the kind of day-to-day solidarity work of the union that is emerging over the last decade, and on Common Frontiers, which is an example of a coalition and a coalition that is now in a hemispheric social alliance trying to work more effectively with other such coalitions in other parts of the Americas. And thirdly, if time permits a little commentary on the World Social Forum. And then I'd also like to talk about two real challenges that I think we face, one a conceptual challenge and one an organizational one. So without further ado, I'll set about on that path. In terms of the labor solidarity and the kind of day-to-day, week-to-week working relations that are emerging, our union, like many, has been involved in solidarity work for many years with peaks and valleys, and whether it's been anti-apartheid work or earlier work on military regimes in Latin America. But I think over the last 15 years, the creation of a development and solidarity fund within the union has really created quite a different dynamic. We, like several other unions, set up a fund. The mechanism is really simple. It's a penny. 500 of our bargaining units have now bargained this into their collective agreements. For an individual worker, it's a cup of coffee a week, $20 on your tax receipt at the end of the year. So it's not a major thing. But that mechanism multiplied by the many workers who are in it results in something like $1 million a year coming in revenue, and that parlayed with work from Canadian CETA results in a substantial budget and therefore a staff and therefore a group of people who go into the union day to day and are responsible for trying to give some shape to what our international connections might look like. And certainly as our employers have gone global, I mean, if ever there was a moment we needed some global agility, this is it. And so this fund has been a very interesting one in terms of creating possibilities for building up ongoing links with partner organizations in different parts of the world. A lot of these, as you would suspect, are trade unions. And so ongoing collaboration with a number of unions, some of it driven by the funding aspect as such, the actual granting of project monies to the unions, other parts of it driven by simply a shared politics and areas of mutual interest. And even where the funding mechanism and the classic donor role plays a part, we often do things much beyond what we do simply through the part of the work of that Southern Union that is actually being funded. Similarly, lots of work with community organizations. The fund has allowed us to have our members come into direct contact with a lot of people's lives in other parts of the world. It has all those dangers that travel does. I mean, and certainly even within our own organization, it's often looked at as if we are simply doing global tourism. But at its best, it has provided an opportunity for a number of our members to really engage with what the shape of the global economy looks like from the point of view of counterparts in the South. Just as some examples of the kinds of exchanges, we recently had 10 people from the Toronto Area Council spend time in Mexico. Many of them are in workplaces where management hovers over workers' shoulders regularly with the threats of packing up work here and heading off south. And so to go to Mexico, to be hosted by the FAT in Mexico, one of the independent labor organizations there, to have a chance to see what the organizing in the maquilas looks like, was a powerful experience. They came back. They decided to set up an ongoing fund that would be apart from anything the Humanity Fund would do to support the organizing work in the maquilas. So that kind of, not dramatic, but a number of lives that were touched by that experience and who've come up with some ways of keeping connected on an area of mutual interest. Sometimes the exchanges are not with our members at all. They're between organizations in the South with whom we work. One of my favorites was an experience in Mozambique where a major new aluminum smelter was being constructed, and the construction workers' union with whom we work regularly found itself in a very daunting set of labor relations with many contractors, with South African workers coming into Mozambique for this construction project. And so we were able to set something up whereby the construction union and the union that would be representing the smelter workers once it became operational went to South Africa, hosted by NUMSA, the metalworkers union in South Africa. And NUMSA introduced the Mozambican unions to the construction unions in South Africa, took them to the twin plant of this aluminum plant with the same owners. And so just, again, not dramatic, but just a useful exchange, a way that that fund allowed those workers to connect and to compare notes on what was going on. They discovered on both sides, the unions were being told things that were blatantly untrue in terms of what possibilities there were for representing workers, and therefore some improvements in that just through that, as I say, non-dramatic exchange, but the kind of gritty day-to-day work that we do. There have been other exchanges that have been regional ones. There was an exchange where we took a poverty activist from Canada and a labor lawyer from Mexico to southern Africa, and they spent time in Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Namibia, and South Africa in a series of events comparing notes on regional trading blocks and on maquilas or export processing zones. So I guess I'd say that over the years, some of these exchanges have become much more focused, and some of the most interesting ones are those that bring together workers who work for the same company. For example, Cominco, a big mining company, one of the many that has gone to Chile in recent years and to other parts of Latin America with the mining boom going on there. I'll just spend a few minutes focusing on that Cominco exchange because I think it throws up lots of lessons in terms of what this kind of work looks like. We now have about 8 years of contacts between Cominco workers in Canada, in Chile, and in Peru. I think we found it was very easy to establish the first exchanges. There's a buzz of excitement. It's the same employer. It's always very interesting. But the real challenge is, how do you sustain these beyond the first exchange visit? And one of the hurdles is language. So one of the things that we did was to use conference calls on a regular basis where we just put the translator back onto the phone with the two unions. Another aspect is very unequal resources between the unions, north and south. Again, in that case, some of the Canadian locals, Cominco locals, responded by contributing money for faxes and for modems for their counterparts in Chile. Other kinds of problems that come up, always these kinds of exchanges, individuals play a big role, and when there are union elections, whether it's in Chile or in Canada, new leaders come up who weren't part of the first group, and sometimes resented who was involved in it in the first instance. So those kinds of questions come up. I think there were lots of surprises as well. I think we imagined that health and safety would just be a shoe-in as a major area of interest, and in fact that hasn't been an area that has generated too much interaction. Bargaining has been perhaps the main area, and the need for the Chileans to really come to grips with what a foreign private Canadian mining company is all about as someone to sit across the table from in bargaining. So we've done bargaining exchanges and amazing moments of insight as the Chileans. Well, they said to us that when they first started working with these Canadian mine owners, and they're people that our members know well because they've dealt with them in our mines in Canada, when they first started dealing with them, they put them in some kind of venerated position, even calling them sir just automatically. But after hanging out a bit with our members and hearing the crazy things that these managers have done in Canada, they were more likely to see them as kind of assholes. So, I mean, this, I think, is all to the good in terms of just demystifying who they were. And certainly the Chileans went into their first round of bargaining with Cominco with a great deal more courage and came out of it, thank goodness, with a very good collective agreement. We were on tenterhooks because it's a very delicate thing to be doing. We kept trying to share whatever of our experience seemed to be relevant without falling into a position of telling them what they should do with their bargaining. And with their inexperience in that first round, that wasn't always an easy posture to maintain, and we were very sure that if the bargaining went badly, that we'd wear it, because the most easy factor to look at was, you know, what was the role of those Canadians in that bargaining. Happily, it went well, and so we wore it, and wore it with pride, because they felt really good about what had come out of the bargaining. But it's that kind of, in some interesting ways, I mean, we worried that the North-South dynamic around protectionism would be something that would come into it in a major way. I think our workers readily understood that their best defense against a race to the bottom that just eroded their standards and salaries, as well as using Chilean labor as a cheap labor force in the international mining world, that their best defense against that was some kind of work that would allow both to emerge going up instead of down. So strengthening the Chilean union, strengthening their capacity to bargain a safe workplace and some dignity into it from their Canadian employers was, in a sense, the best bet for the Canadian workers as well. And for the Chilean workers, I mean, I guess one of the dynamics that was very interesting in terms of the North-South dynamic was the dynamic around, not around North-South workers, but North-South in the sense of this as a big Canadian investment, part of what Team Canada does when it goes off to these countries, and the Chilean government responding in kind. This was a wonderful investment. It was going to create miracles in Chile. And so the work of the unions in terms of debunking what these work sites actually looked like, and one of the interesting moments was in a meeting with the Canada-Chile Trade Agreement labor panel, where one of our members who'd recently been in Chile went to that meeting and spoke very heatedly and very knowledgeably about the conditions of the Chilean workers in these mines. The Chilean government officials who were at this meeting were apparently staggered. I mean, they said to him afterwards that they really liked the emotion with which he spoke. But they went back then to Chile, apparently, and very quickly set up a commission of inquiry into conditions in this mine. So somehow the phenomenon of hearing labor problems in Chile aired in an international forum by a Canadian counterpart had a weight in that situation that the kind of complaints that the Chilean unions themselves had lodged with their own government officials, there was a far greater effect from the Canadian intervention. And I think this kind of gritty day-to-day work, I mean, I've just belabored the Cominco example, but there are other examples that I could have given. Some of that culminated in what we were able to do in Quebec during the People's Summit, where we sponsored, not alone, but in concert with these counterpart organizations in Brazil, Chile, Peru, and Mexico, a commission of inquiry on corporate conduct in the Americas. Certainly, 10 years ago, we couldn't have dreamed of such a thing, but there's now a reality of month-to-month communications back and forth, a level of trust in terms of what each organization is doing that allowed us to work in concert to pull together that event, and I think that kind of new action together is a very interesting one. Clearly, time is not going to allow me to do nearly what I'd hoped to do in this presentation, but just speaking very briefly about some of the new coalitions and alliances, I just want to touch a little bit on some of the work that's being done through Common Frontiers, because I think in this new kind of North-South work, a lot of it is done through networks, a lot of it is done through alliances, and again, they may show up most dramatically at summit-type events, and both their strengths and their weaknesses are out there on display at those events, but between such events, there's a lot of work that goes on that just, in a very systematic way, tries to keep North and South connected. So around the trade work, this has happened. Once we were drawn into the FTA with the U.S., already there were strong connections with U.S. counterparts, and when Chile came into NAFTA, this continued with a major meeting in Zacatecas that took 45 activists to Mexico, and out of that now really a decade of ongoing work. A lot of it has been trilateral work between the networks in those three countries, weekly phone calls, regular communications in terms of back and forth, common events, common statements, common strategies. I think a lot of what makes it work is that there is a huge amount of respect that's the underlying basis for it. There is no presumption that any one country is the leader in this. Each of us is grappling with what these trade agreements have meant in terms of their impact on our own countries. And it's that analysis that is our sort of first calling card at the table in the coalitions. But from that analysis of how the trade agreements are impacting on our own countries, we've found an awful lot of terrain that allows for common action and for common analysis and common strategy. So I put that out very briefly as another example of the coalition work. I think I'm just going to leave the World Social Forum for the moment. It may come up in the questions or it may come up in the workshop, but I'd like to just spend a few minutes looking at a couple of the major challenges as I bring this to a close. I think the first one that I want to focus on is the challenge to do with language and the whole concept of democracy. We've just had this official summit of the Americas in Quebec that gave us both a wall of shame but also gave us a democracy clause. And so one of the outcomes of the meeting of the 34 heads of state in Ottawa, or in Quebec City, rather, was a clause that stated that any institutional alteration or rupture of the democratic order in a state in the hemisphere constitutes an insurmountable obstacle for the participation of that state in the process of the Summit of the Americas. I mean, we could spend time on the absurdity of an idea of democracy which gives passing grades to Colombia and other equally dubious regimes and singles out Cuba as the only country for whom it's a problem. But leaving that aside, I think the difficulty for us is that those seemingly inconsistent outcomes, a wall of shame and a democracy clause, are really not inconsistent. That what we find now is that the neoliberal model that has shaped the global economy for the past 30 years has pushed this notion of free markets and democracy and come up with something that's probably best characterized as a kind of market democracy. And so this market democracy that is being pushed by the transnationals is the kind that the Democracy Clause speaks to. And it's a kind of democracy that has nothing to do with the sort of democracy that we would normally be seeking in this room. In our bargaining in the steelworkers, we talk about weasel words, words that mean one thing to management and one thing to workers. And I think democracy has become definitely a weasel word. And so rather than democracy having to do with any kind of transformation of unjust socioeconomic structures or any democratization of cultural and political and social life, democracy in the hands of the neoliberal folk is about rotating elites and periodic elections. And I think one of our real challenges is to find a language that captures the kind of alternative world we're seeking, this new world that's possible, that has been so affirmed in the World Social Forum and in many other events since. But how to find a language that captures the kind of democracy that we're in fact seeking. I think clearly the fundamental principles of an alternative to global competitiveness have to do with things like sustainability, diversity, social justice, citizen participation, democratic accountability. And the challenge is to find ways to nurture and celebrate the spaces where these are emerging. But perhaps even bigger challenge is to really carry out the kind of social experimentation that's needed for us to establish new socioeconomic forms that are actually governed by those principles. For me, that's the hopefulness of Porto Alegre, that it really is a space that is not about protest, but a space that is about construction, about visioning, about trying to bring together activists from throughout the world in a forum that allows us to really celebrate examples of new kinds of institutions, and that part of Brazil is rich in them. It's fascinating to see at both a municipal and state level a government that takes tackling poverty and social exclusion as the basis for its policies and really comes up with new ways of doing things, whether it's garbage collection, whether it's participatory budgets, whether it's environment, whether it's the role of citizen and the relationship between citizen and those in power. So I think that's the hopefulness of Porto Alegre, and that's the challenge to us to really carry out that kind of social experimentation and work towards a world that's very different from the one that the top-down globalizers are forcing upon us. Thank you.